Episode 30. Are We Alone?
Nearly five centuries before the birth of Christ, the Greek philosopher Anaxagoras made an astounding assertion regarding other worlds.
Men have been formed, and other animals which have life. The men, too, have inhabited cities and cultivated fields as with us. They have a sun and a moon, and their earth produces for them many things of various kinds, the best of which they gather together into their dwellings and live upon.
In other words, Anaxagoras believed in alien life. And 2.5 millennia on, so does astronomer Jill Tarter, head of the SETI Institute in California. SETI is an acronym for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. On the 12th of October 1992, Columbus Day in America, Jill had a momentous task to perform. We were all at Arecibo in Puerto Rico, dazzled by the sight of the world's biggest radio telescope nestled in the greenery of the island's jungles. The giant dish, 26 football fields in size, had been tuned to listen in for whispers from intelligent life in the universe. We were about to celebrate the official start of humankind's ultimate quest. Jill flung the switch on the cosmic leviathan and uttered,
"Let the search commence."
The first data began to pour in, over millions of radio frequencies from hundreds of stars. Jill considered the nature of what she and her team were embarking upon.
Is anybody out there? It's the oldest unanswered question our species has posed to itself.
The father of SETI is Frank Drake.
During my doctoral thesis at Harvard in the 50s, I became intrigued with the possibility that we might really be able to find E.T. But back then, the ideas of life in the universe were not considered very reputable subjects in science.
Young Drake was not deterred by the orthodoxy. Instead of using a conventional optical telescope, he surveyed the heavens with a giant radio dish, looking for exploding stars and violent galaxies. Radio waves travel through space virtually unimpeded. Could extraterrestrials, he wondered, use a radio telescope in reverse to broadcast signals across the cosmos? His bold vision seemed to come true when he was observing the beautiful Pleiades star cluster.
I'd done this many nights before, but on this occasion, there suddenly appeared a very strong narrowband signal, which could only be the product of intelligent activity.
To check if the signal really was coming from the Pleiades, Drake slewed his dish to a different part of the sky.
Well, it turned out that when I moved the telescope, the signal was still there, so it was truly from Earth, which was a disappointment. But the seed was planted.
And, over the last decade or so, there's been a growing conviction that life in the universe must be commonplace. Put together the facts that we already know of over 300 planets orbiting other stars, and that the chemicals that make life, in particular carbon, are common in space. And it seems unlikely that we are alone. Astrobiologists have recently been discovering just what extremes life on Earth can tolerate. There are bacteria that can live in nuclear reactors, at the bottom of deep boreholes, in the cold of Antarctica, and in the superheated pools of Earth's hot springs. So, could there even be extreme life elsewhere in our solar system? Mars has always seen the best candidate. Although it's just half the size of Earth, it has evidence of water and volcanoes in its past, and there's a thin atmosphere. In 1877, the Italian astronomer Giovanni Schiaparelli thought he saw regular lines crossing the red planet's surface. He called them canali, channels. Word spread to the States, where canali was translated into canals. Percival Lowell believed the canals were the sign of a doomed civilization on a dying planet, desperately trying to bring water down from the Martian polar ice caps to the deserts at the equator. The author H.G. Wells thought it was a great story. His War of the Worlds relates how Martians flee their doomed world and head for the fecund Earth, intent on obliterating all Earthlings and taking the planet over. The concept of life on Mars was firmly on the agenda. In 1976, NASA sent the twin Viking probes to the Red Planet. Each lander contained a miniature laboratory with a 10-foot-long arm to feed it with soil samples. There were four main experiments. Three were designed to look for signs of life in the soil, while the fourth analysed the soil for organic carbon compounds. The last experiment detected no carbon compounds, and if there's no organic carbon, there's no life. So, NASA's official line is that there is no life on Mars. It's been rendered sterile by ultraviolet radiation from the sun. But I became intrigued by one of the Viking experiments that seemed to contradict the orthodoxy, which is how I came to meet up with a sanitary engineer at a light industrial estate in Beltsville, Maryland. Gil Levine, CEO of Biospherics Inc., was a senior member of the Viking team. He explained his experiment to me.
I developed a method to detect microorganisms very quickly, as a result of a need I saw when I was a public health engineer. I was an investigator on the labelled release experiment. That's the one that got a positive indication for life on Mars and has kept me in trouble ever since.
When results from Levine's experiment started to come in, one researcher in the control room exclaimed,
My God, there may be life there.
But NASA had made up its collective mind that there was no life on Mars, because they'd found no carbon compounds. And Gil Levine's outspoken claims turned him into an agency exile. On the opposite coast of the States, I visited the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at La Jolla in California. A team there is assembling a new experiment to analyse the soil of Mars. Team member Danny Glavin commented,
"You have to remember that the Vikings were in 1976. We've recently done some really interesting experiments with our new Mars organic detector. We estimate that Vikings would have missed out on the order of 30 million bacteria cells per gram of soil."
Though sparse by terrestrial standards, that's still a lot of bacteria to miss. And whether or not life exists on Mars now, there have been tantalising hints that it was there in the past. In 1996, a team from the Johnson Space Center in Houston analysed a meteorite that had fallen on the pristine snows of Antarctica. From its composition, scientists knew that the rock had been blasted out of Mars by a collision with an asteroid, later to land on Earth. The researchers were astonished to find that it contained what appeared to be microscopic, fossilised maggots. The finding provoked a furore. Newspaper headlines screamed out, "Life on Mars, official!" While President Bill Clinton proclaimed,
"Today, Rock 84001 speaks to us across all those billions of years and millions of miles. If this discovery is confirmed, it will surely be one of the most stunning insights into our universe that science has ever uncovered."
In spite of the plethora of probes circling Mars and roving its surface, the jury is still out when it comes to the question of life on Mars. But could there be life further out in the solar system? Spacecraft probing the giant outer planets Jupiter and Saturn have had close-up views of these planets' moons. Some astronomers believe that they're more likely to be the abode of life than the red planet itself. But what about life, and in particular, intelligent life, outside the solar system? The discovery of planets orbiting other stars was a real spur to the SETI astronomers. But nearly half a century after Frank Drake's wake-up call, when he'd thought he detected a signal from the Pleiades, the team still hasn't received a phone call from ET. Maybe the aliens are there, but silent. After all, humankind has done little to advertise our presence to the universe at large. The first attempt was made at Arecibo in 1974, when Frank Drake was the director of the giant radio telescope. The dish had been resurfaced, and Drake wanted a ceremony to celebrate the event. His PA came up with a brilliant suggestion. Why don't you use it in reverse and beam a signal to the universe? Drake recalls the occasion.
In the middle of the celebration, we transmitted to the stars in the direction of the Great Globular Cluster M13. This is a group of 300,000 stars, 25,000 light-years away from us. The message was made in a code that was easy to break. We showed the basic chemistry of life on Earth, the DNA molecule, and the arrangement of our solar system. And we gave our population, Earth size, and the size of the telescope which sent it.
Drake, in collaboration with Carl Sagan, went further. They designed plaques on the sides of the two pioneer spacecraft destined for Jupiter and Saturn, and which are now heading out of the solar system. If any extraterrestrials had located the spacecraft, they would have learned about our knowledge of science, our perception of the universe, and even our anatomy. The twin Voyager craft, also aimed at the outer planets but destined to escape towards the stars, were more modest and contained an old-fashioned LP record on their sides, complete with a stylus. The discs were encoded with sounds, pictures, and messages from Earth. Robot messengers, like the Pioneers and Voyagers, may be the way to carry our thoughts, our senses, and our knowledge into the community of extraterrestrial life, and a first step to going there ourselves. Historian of astronomy, Ed Krupp, puts our latest vision of cosmic exploration into perspective.
We live in an era where we have transformed the sky. We don't just look into it, we go into it, and we bring it back to us. With discoveries of astronomical consequence that are every bit as mystifying, every bit as imaginative, every bit as compelling as the sky was to our ancestors.
And this voyage of celestial discovery is far from over. We're experiencing a new revolution in the history of astronomy, one that directly connects humankind with the cosmos. As the astronomer Ellie Arroway, in Carl Sagan's novel Contact, relates of her vision of the universe.
A vision that tells us how undeniably tiny and insignificant and how rare and precious we all are. A vision that tells us we belong to something that is greater than ourselves. That we are not. That none of us are alone.
Cosmic Quest was written and presented by Heather Cooper. The readers were Timothy West, Annette Badland, Robin Sebastian, John Palmer and Julian Rhine-Tutt. The series was produced by Martin Redfern, and you can hear the omnibus edition of this week's episodes tonight at 9.
BBC News at 4 o'clock. Detectives in